At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Hi, and welcome back to another episode. It's our 25th episode. We're a quarter of the way to our big centennial celebration.
Let's keep it up. How are you doing today?
I'm doing really well. I'm really excited for this show. Very, very excited. But first and foremost, how are you?
I'm good. Guess I'm trending on X, Vermont.
Yeah, politics. Let's talk about that a little bit. Here's Chris. If you guys aren't following Chris out there, he's rage baiting everyone.
Yeah.
Chris gets more engagement on his personal profile than we do on the big account just by rage baiting people with Maduro.
At the end of the day, I just want to be on the right side of history like I've been all throughout and you have been. But I just want to say, we've seen it all. We've all seen it all. And again, we're getting sucked into an endless war that doesn't need to happen because the deep state ghouls want it. So we're all about supporting Venezuela. We're all about supporting Palestine. And I just don't give a fuck. Usually if the U.S. is saying something, I'm the opposite. So that's it. Look at what a handsome guy.
That was so good. And I said, you know what? I'm going to share this on the big account because we've got a good reputation for this, right? Somebody says, that Brian Berlenic.
That's yours truly. But you know, the great thing is that a lot of MAGA people are melting down because they're like, he's one of our own.
Yeah, they didn't know.
Oh my God. I know.
It's crazy.
the tears of MAGA.
Yeah. Well, first and foremost, I really, really want to thank you guys for all of your support, especially on YouTube. It's been going really incredibly, and that's because of, oh my God, put a beard on it. Yes, please. But it's because of all of you guys, and I couldn't be more grateful for we're not big, we're not like Candace Owens or anybody, but I'm just really excited that we have momentum and that we're garnering so much positive feedback and support. It's really, really awesome, and we do appreciate that. Also, we will continue with our reading of Atrocity Propaganda. We've been doing that in spaces. I think we took a little bit of a break for the holiday. Chris is going viral. We're getting our ass kicked with the new algorithm. If you hate the new algorithm on X, please let us know. I guess it's us versus Chris right now. Algorithm space. We're going to go into a lot of detail today. I told people a lot about it yesterday in the space. I did a 10-hour space yesterday
about stuff
we're going to really go into depth into today. But it is still on my profile. If you're ever bored and have a spare 10 hours, I guess you might want to go back and listen to it. There was a lot of interesting things covered in that space. And a lot of suspicious people kind of lurking around on X. And you know, I'm getting a little bit weirded out. People have very interesting opinions, and then you kind of press them on them, and they don't necessarily have things to back them up or any reasoning that makes any sense. Or maybe they hold a lot of Bitcoin, or they just went to El Salvador, just something strange, just a lot of strange people out there. Thank you so much, Chai, stranded in Mexico or something. But, just a lot of weird characters and this El Salvador thing, I think I'm gonna go down a little bit of rabbit hole. Not today. We're gonna do a stream on or a space on that. I think tomorrow something is very weird going on with El Salvador, and we are going to talk more about that. Thank you, TJ. I agree. You know, it takes more people to start calling out this nonsense. If you guys don't feel right, you know, there's something that you really sometimes you have to trust your gut. And you just have to say, what is going on? You have to tell me what your motivations are or why you have these weird opinions that don't make any sense. And then, you know, you kind of dig a little bit and you figure it out. I think we'll, and tomorrow's space won't be personal. It's not a personal attack, but there's something very fishy and interesting going on with El Salvador and American, maybe Western influencers. So maybe we'll dive further into that. But anyway, in the real world, I guess, or back on not our complaints and venting, the zone is absolutely flooded, like flooded. Trump is screaming about immigrants. His approval rating is plummeting. So much is happening. We're not even going to be able to really go into detail about like or updates about the shooting, National Guard shooting, another shooting following that, and then another shooting at a child's birthday party. It's just everything is chaos. So I what I will do is I'll play this clip from Pam Bondi that I think sums up where we're at pretty well. I think you guys should be able to comprehend what she's really trying to say.
We're working hand in hand with Pete Hegseth. And yes, we are bringing in our National Guard to every city we possibly can. Who needs our help? And that's a lot of them. We're tied up, as you know, in a lot of court hearings right now. These young men and women in the Guard, they want to help our country. They want to be here. They are patriots. Yet they will not be attacked by a radical Islamic terrorist who screams by reports, Ali Akbar, before shooting two of our Guard members and almost killing more.
Yeah, can you...
The most important parts obviously are we are putting National Guard in every city we can.
Oh, interesting. Cheers. Sounds familiar.
Do my little nini.
sounds familiar. I just got to say, you know, everybody's been calling us wacko conspiracy theorists for a long time. I'm just saying. Stuff's turning out the way we predicted on a lot of levels, on a lot of issues. I'm just saying. I hate to be right.
So you hate to be right because the people hate you for it. But anyway, you know, we've talked about it. We talked about them moving behind the bases. What's really going on? Why are they out putting Tulsi out? Why aren't they taking Marjorie Taylor Greene's death threat seriously? What's really going on? And now this.
Yeah.
Now this. And of course, Ali Akbar. Guys, for my Muslim brothers and sisters, I corrected that in the captions because when I was doing it, it popped up Ali Akbar. I was like, what? And then I went and listened. I was like, oh, dear. But, like, you know.
Did I say somebody's name?
Yes, that's what I thought. I was like, who is Ali? Ali Akbar. But yeah, so I think that's really indicative of what's going on. A clueless AG talking about martial law and Islamic terrorists with CIA connections screaming Ali Akbar, Ali Ali Oxenfree or something. I don't. But that's basically where we are right now. And while everything is kind of imploding, it's like immigrants. And I do agree that there is an immigrant issue and that needs to be addressed. But that's this is such a distraction. This is maybe a distraction.
Maybe if the U.S. would stop meddling in the affairs in Latin America and leave the people at peace and stop turning all these countries into little banana republics, maybe we wouldn't have an immigration crisis to begin with. People don't want to leave their home normally. But when you bomb them and coup them and support Contras and overthrow their governments and, oh, my God, they support trade unions. Let's go and, you know, show them democracy and free markets. And you have this shock doctrine for 30, 40, 50, 60 years. What do you expect to be the case? You know, I was just reading today again about Arbenz and stuff like that. We've been meddling in there for over a century. Why? And now they're like, oh, immigration. Yeah. No shit, Sherlock, it's going to be an immigration crisis. But maybe that's the deeper reason, because you need a crisis to continue to create crises. So, of course, if you don't have an immigration crisis, people are going to say, well, what's going on? Why do we need to go to war with these people? What's going on? And let's not forget, if drugs are the issue, who are the biggest drug dealers? The CIA and the DEA. Let's be honest about that. If you got a problem with supply, you ultimately have a problem with consumption. So I'm just saying. There's a lot more to this story, a lot more.
And we will get very deep into South America, Latin America. First, we'll cover Russia, Ukraine. There's a little bit of an update there. Well, let's hear from Putin. This is a little bit long, but this is his opinion on the sort of state of where things are at. And you know, we have an update, obviously, from up to about an hour ago.
Проектов договора не было. Был набор вопросов, которые предлагалось обсудить и сформулировать окончательно. В целом, я уже говорил много раз, этот счет. Мы перед моим визитом в США, перед визитом на Аляску, обсуждали это с американскими переговорщиками. И после этого возник вот тот перечень возможных договоренностей из 28 пунктов. И, как я уже объявлял публично, он нам по определенным каналам был передан. Мы с ним ознакомились. После этого состоялись переговоры в Женеве между американской делегацией и украинской делегацией. И они, я так понял, между собой решили, что все эти 28 пунктов нужно разделить на 4 составляющих отдельных. В целом, да, и нам это все было передано. В целом мы согласны, что это может быть положено в основу будущих договоренностей. Но было бы с моей стороны невежливо сейчас вот говорить о каких-то окончательных вариантах, но их, поскольку их нет. Ну, некоторые вещи они носят принципиальный характер. И в целом мы видим, что американская сторона учитывает нашу, в чем-то учитывает нашу позицию, которая обсуждалась до Анкориджа и после Аляски. Где-то нам точно совершенно нужно садиться и серьезно обсуждать какие-то конкретные вещи. Нужно все положить на дипломатический язык. Потому что одно дело, в общем, сказать, что Россия не собирается нападать на Европу. Это для нас звучит смешно, правда? Никогда не собирались. Но если они хотят услышать от нас, ну давайте мы это зафиксируем. Вопросов нет. Просто там есть люди, мне кажется, они не в себе немножко. Когда публично или жулики какие-то, что-то они за это хотят получить, публично своему населению, своим гражданам говорят, что вот Россия готовится к нападению на Европу, и нам нужно немедленно укреплять, значит, свой оборонный потенциал. То ли они обслуживают интересы промышленности, частных компаний, то ли они на этом фоне как-то стараются поднять свои внутриполитические рейтинги, имея в виду плачевное состояние экономики, социальной сферы. Но трудно сказать, чем они руководствуются, но с нашей точки зрения это полная чушь, это ложь.
So again, we're kind of at this place where the Russians are like, this peace plan is, what's going on in Russia? What is the general sentiment about the Trump? Russian language is very weird, and it's hard to translate it into English to a way that is effective, because Russian language is so much more flowery and literary, and it's very emotional and poetic. So English doesn't always convey exactly what they're trying to say. So I kind of like to play all of his clips and then kind of let Chris or myself dive into it a little bit further.
The Russians are basically saying, look, we reached some level of understanding in Alaska. So let's go back in time. Under the Biden administration, Russian diplomatic language basically said, we are in an abnormal period of bilateral relations, which is that Russia and the United States were not having normal dialogue. We're not being able to communicate leader to leader, State Department to Ministry of Foreign Affairs. And it wasn't done in a normal diplomatic way. Now, after, you know, now since Witkoff has started going this year, and especially in the Alaska phase, we finally had the opportunity for a sit down between the President of the United States and the President of the Russian Federation. Now, what Putin is saying is, okay, we have agreed in principle to certain things. However, all of these things are sort of flowery and in the air. They need to be put down concretely and, as he rightfully points out, in diplomatic terms. So the idea that somehow there need to be guarantees that Russia doesn't attack Europe, what guarantees, number one? Number two, Russia never intended to attack Europe. If Russia wanted to attack Europe, they could do it today or tomorrow. But they don't intend to do that. So a lot of these things strike the Russians as being stumbling blocks to a real diplomatic solution. Because ultimately, they're totally unnecessary. Because there's nothing, there's no indication of that. So the Russians are saying, look, if you want to address the issues, again, to say it like we always do, you have to address the root causes to the conflict. And still, They have not done that. They want to get this done quickly. They want to open up business again. We'll get to that part later. Mm-hmm. But the Americans do not seem interested in addressing the root causes because they know that a lot of those root issues will remain major stumbling blocks between all of the people that would have to agree to this, or at least sign off on it, or at least go along with it. And I think that that's one of the major issues here. So the Russians are basically saying, look, America is like a toddler screaming out or a teenager lashing out this and that, changing opinions back and forth. Russia remains stable as a partner and wants to have a dialogue that is constructive and ultimately leads to something, but that is fruitful, but that takes into account all of the positions of the Russian Federation. We're not at that point yet.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that the wording of the initial 28 points almost offended the Russians when they read it? Like the language about, oh, Russia will not invade Europe. And Putin's like, why does it even need to be in there? Like,
yeah, of course. I mean, it was just sort of seen as very childish. It was seen as not really something very serious. Of course, some of the points were considered, you know, a little bit better and more serious. But there's a balancing act here, a balancing act between diplomatic interests, financial interests, political interests, social interests, and also military interests and objectives. So there's a lot at play. And I think that the Russians want all of those things to be considered. Like, for example, in the initial 28-point plan that we read, there was the seizure of Russian assets to pay for Ukrainian reconstruction to the tune of $100 billion. That's just not going to happen. You can't get business off the ground that way. So there's a lot of those issues at play. And that factors into the article that we'll talk about a little bit later and into a lot of the bilateral negotiations that are going on between the United States and the Russian Federation at this point.
And so let's hear from Masha just as a treat, because we love her.
Для нас же угрозой по-прежнему является экспансия НАТО. Вот с этой темы почему-то они как-то не стремятся заходить в публичное пространство. Для нас угрозой по-прежнему остается и стремление НАТО затащить в свою орбиту Украину. Членство этой страны в агрессивном военном альянсе, который провозгласил своей целью, так сказать, Россию, назвав ее угрозой безопасности во всех операционных средах.
So once again, the NATO language in the European counterplan, stating that, and I think Trump actually acquiesced to that. He said that's going to have to be up to Europe in the end, and that's a non-starter. That's just the fact that it's even in there is a non-starter. Especially for the foreign ministry. And now we'll get into that our article that Chris was alluding to. This explosive article came out in the Wall Street Journal, Make Money, Not War, Trump's Real Plan for Peace in Ukraine. I did make it a gift article. I shared it on my personal profile. I can share it again or put the link on my personal or make account if you guys want it. It's incredibly long. But as we suspected that this peace plan or behind the curtain or something, Witkoff has been making deals with the Russians, mostly Witkoff, Kushner and their cronies, presenting things as a business first grift. They are eyeing billions in Russian deals, sidelining Ukrainian sovereignty and Europe's security. And so the reaction from the pro-Ukraine crowd has been tremendous.
Oh, meltdown. Global level.
But I don't, and you know what? I understand. Now, don't forget, I want to remind our viewers, in the 1980s, when, you know, the Soviet Union was starting to get a little bit weird, Trump was going to build a Trump Tower across from the Kremlin. Yep. That is something that Trump still wants to do. It's like his Nobel Peace Prize. It's that thing that I've never gotten done, and I can get it done before I die. And you think Putin's going to let him put a Trump Tower across the street from the effing Kremlin?
I don't think so.
When Putin went on his visit to Kyrgyzstan, they hid the U.S. and Ukrainian embassies from view. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. There's gonna be a Trump Tower. I sent you the article. Did you get a chance to read it? What are your thoughts? I mean, we said about the plan, we were like, this sounds like something that these two numbskulls wrote on the way back from Gaza, their Gaza debacle. It reads just like Gaza, et cetera. So has there been any reaction in Russia? You've read the article. What are your thoughts?
Listen, I mean, I acknowledge many of the things in the article. And I also think that Russia, of course, is a complex state. And it's also, in many ways, an enigma, as many have pointed out throughout history. And the fact is that the Kremlin has numerous ways of trying to deal with conflicts internationally. And it has numerous mechanisms and, you know, sort of levers of control over certain situations. Certainly, President Putin would be wise to use someone educated in the U.S. With a business acumen to try to reach the U.S. on a different level than the Biden administration. Now, I know that you're scoffing like that because I'll show you why I think this and why I think it's important. Kirill Dmitriev and Medvedev both have high political office in Russia, and both are allowed at the state level to say their own lines about what's going on. And I want to say that the Kremlin gives a wide sort of a wide opening to different positions and basically uses a wide arsenal to ensure Russia's strategic interests. So certainly I think that there is on one level a way to get business going. But think about it this way. Accessing Russian assets that are frozen is something that can happen immediately if agreed upon. Building businesses with the United States takes time. So think about it on a timeline level. If Russia can access hundreds of billions of dollars in seized assets, it understands that that repatriation of financial wealth will be enormously impactful. And it knows that it has a stopgap in terms of time for a lot of these businesses that would take off the ground. Why? Because Russians know that if a democratic administration comes back into power in the United States, sanctions could be back on them. So listen to this. Think about it in the Iranian sense, because Iran did a similar tactical move, but ended up not being successful fully. Iran tried to reach the nuclear deal in large part to be able to get back a lot of their financial net worth that was locked up in Western accounts or locked up internationally because of sanctions. It was only able to repatriate a little bit of that money until, as you saw, the deal was scuttled and they weren't able to do that. The Russians want to play with that timeline a little bit better. And they want to say, if we can reach an agreement 1-2 years before Trump's term expires and we don't know who comes next, we can at least get all that money out. Because let me put it this way. The Russian leadership would be making a very big strategic mistake if they tried to integrate back with the West like they did before. And I think that nobody here, at least on the patriotic nationalist crowd, wants to do that. I think, yes, people want to go back to Europe and shop and people want to go to New York and fly and buy nice things. But nobody wants to have a similar blowback in terms of sanctions regime again. So I think that they want to balance these interests. That's why I think that there's a strategy to this. And I think that with people in play in all of these political forces, I think that there's other layers to this. But certainly, I think it was very interesting, the article, in terms of the ongoing negotiations at the business strategic level, because NATO is also militarizing the Arctic. The Russians are saying, explore the Arctic. So there's a very interesting balance here into what's actually going on. Don't forget, 7 of the 8 Arctic countries are NATO members. Mm-hmm. The 8th country is Russia. So you have to understand that this is one of the major front lines in the next strategic conflict. Trump mentioned the icebreakers, right? Oh, we only have one. Russia has 48 and he wants to build more. So I just want us to think that certainly there's a business aspect and economic aspect to this, but underlying it is also a deeply, I think, unsettling geopolitical and geostrategic level that the Russians are trying to game and trying to buy time with.
I don't trust Kirill Dmitriev. He's a Goldman Sachs alum and a United States educated. But I think that now, like talking through, I think there's a strategic, I was kind of saying like, you know, he's kind of there to kind of schmooze and booze, and I don't like him. I'm sorry if you guys do. I think he's there. He's kind of a buffoon. He's a QAnon believer. Like, I can't imagine that I don't know how Russia or the Kremlin insiders feel about QAnon, but I just can't imagine him being taken that seriously. But he does have a business acumen, but he also helps to make the Americans look buffoonish, I think. He gives me bad. He looks clownish. His behavior is clownish. When the Americans behave with him, they look clownish, like Anna Paulina Luna. That was a very weird event. Same thing with Witkoff. Witkoff looks even more clownish. It's just, I don't really get a good vibe from Dmitriev, but, you know, maybe you're right. It's very weird, and I'm not comfortable with it, but I can understand the idea behind unlocking those assets. But there's also a lot of things that the Americans want to piggyback on this, which is Palantir, SpaceX. They want to use they want Russian cooperation with SpaceX to go to Mars. They want to put data centers in Ukraine. They're looking all over the globe to put these ridiculous data centers. So it's a lot of stuff that is just yucky and stuff that's like, yeah, that Russia has been doing its best. I mean, we've been to conferences for it to avoid bringing in these huge AI tech giants. And these are kind of these types of things are very Trojan horse like.
I think on a deeper level, the Russians completely know this. I mean, we've just had a whole experience of this. I think that the US has always understood, especially in Soviet times, that the Soviet machinery would operate in numerous ways at numerous levels. And I think that the Russians still operate in many of these ways and use these. Like, for example, I just got a message today that the US congressmen and women are coming to Moscow as part of this Representative Luna, you know, they're coming to the Duma. So I just think that certainly some levels are working and certainly levers are being pulled. But There's a strict timeline to all of this, because we're going to have midterms in 2026 and then a general election in 2028. So there's only but I'll tell you this, go a layer deeper. Think about internal Russian politics. You know, a lot of people have sacrificed a lot for the special military operation. And you know that there was an episode in more modern Russian history that saw some, you know, military conflict within the country, right? Some of those sentiments have not gone away, right? So one must balance all of these things when understanding what's going on. There's a lot of heroic soldiers who've given everything for their motherland or fatherland. They use both. So I think that the Russian state understands that and must also recognize their sacrifice and the goals, the stated goals of the special military operation, which are the denazification and the reunification of the four territories, which are, and of course, Crimea, which are now constitutionally enshrined in the Russian Federation. So a lot of this talk about freezing the lines in like Kherson and Zaporozhye and just liberating Donetsk and Lugansk, well, Lugansk already is liberated, but Donetsk, I think that that won't play very well to people. I think that people want to see it, at least these four regions, fully integrated.
And I think that the public sentiment has become more disenchanted with America, even since I was last in Moscow, which was just over a year ago. And they were kind of psyched up to get, you know, to see Trump in office and stuff like that. And, you know, I follow obviously Russians with Attitude, who is fantastic. And then amongst some other Russian accounts that have, I remember one post from Russians with Attitude recently was saying like, oh, something about US bombs so Ukrainians can throw them at our civilians. And it was very like a direct connection from Trump, US bombs directly to dead Russian civilians. And I was wondering if that was like sort of a public understanding finally, or public sentiment. Like maybe they did all think that things might change a bit when Trump came into office, and they've actually deteriorated in a sense, especially for the civilians.
Listen, you know, when I speak about the Trump administration, I always speak that under the first Trump administration, The American government trained Azov, right, sector, all these groups, trained the Ukrainian military for 4 years, supplied them with weapons, and were directly responsible through these supplies and training for the killing of civilians in the Donbass. So I don't want to hear that Trump is a friend, because he's not a friend. If he was a friend, he would have stopped that back then. We wouldn't even have had a 2022 if he was serious about it in 2017, 2018, 2019, 2020, which he was not. So I just want to say, I just try to say that, look, maybe there's a business level to this, but the deeper political and strategic level is that for the United States, Russia will always be at best an adversary and at worst, an enemy. And so that's U.S. strategic thinking. It won't change. Everybody who comes out of Georgetown School of Foreign Service, everybody who comes out of Tufts School for diplomacy, the Fletcher School, everybody who comes out of all of these elite institutions, they are trained in a Russophobic, Sinophobic way. They are trained that Russia is authoritarian, China is authoritarian, DPRK is authoritarian, Iran is an Islamic theocracy, all these things. Venezuela is a dictatorship. Cuba is a dictatorship. Nicaragua is a dictatorship. That's just ingrained in them. So that the structures of our diplomatic corps, the structures of our national security establishment, the structure of our NGO think tank establishment is deeply embedded in that. Do you think that the RAND Corporation is going to change tomorrow, or the Heritage Foundation, or all these groups that are out there? Do we think the Institute for the Study of War at West Point is going to change their perspectives about Russia and things like that? No, none of that is going away. None of that is going away. Trump is going to go away eventually. All those people will stay. They are career people. So I want people to understand that. And I tried to have the Russians understand that, that any sort of liberal fantasies from the Yeltsin era should already be gone. But some still linger among some people who are nostalgic for that. It's got to go away. We are living in a multipolar world. I'm not saying let's have war with the U.S., although the U.S. has imposed a war on the Russian Federation. I'm saying the U.S., Russia should see the U.S. as somebody that they can on one level do business with, but on another level, we'll see them as an adversary and continue to do that. And they must judge their relationships accordingly. That's what I really tried to convey here.
I agree. And we talked about this last episode, and I think my episode before that, but the corruption scams are flying out of Ukraine. Yet another one comes out. Do you guys remember the $1 million a piece Lancet replica drones by Anduril? They don't fucking work. So good job laundering $1 million drone money in and out of Ukraine. So that's good. But good for Russia, I guess. And I guess maybe Russia should encourage more business contracts with people like Anduril and all these companies, Oracle, who's billions of dollars in debt. Anywho, we did have
I just want to add two more things to the article. The article had two really interesting parts that I took out. The first one was that during the Alaska summit, according to the article, Putin started to go into a 1,000-year history of the conflict and talking about how Russians and Ukrainians were the same people. And I guess that sort of derailed everything, and eventually they had to cancel the lunch. And so, of course, I posted yesterday, but I basically said, this is the best. The Americans don't like historical context and don't like any of the historical background. But Putin clearly, every time he speaks about this issue, has to go into history, because in the Russian mind, this is also a historical issue. This is an issue of history and historical.
I think that they're reminded at least once a day that the Americans still don't understand
what exactly. Exactly. Right.
Like, all right, I guess we'll do this again.
Exactly. So that was one level that was amazing, which of course, you know, people were talking about when Tucker did the interview with Putin, but it lingers on, and it's just how Putin is. It's how most Russians are about, you know, really thinking about this. The second thing was the CIA, the CIA director, former directors, or one of the CIA officials' sons who ended up coming and fighting in the special military operation and was killed here. They referred to him in the article when they say that Putin gave Witkoff the Order of Lenin to give to his family because he was motivated by sort of, you know, socialist communist values and came to fight for Russia. And they referred to that son that was killed as mentally unsound. I think it was I have the exact quote here. Let me just pull it up here, because mentally unwell son. So I thought that was very interesting that the CIA, it's a CIA deputy director, the CIA deputy director's son who fought for Russia, I guess the article was trying to basically show that anybody who fights for Russia coming from the West is mentally unwell. Aww. So I thought, come on. I mean, this is, first of all,
a little bit mentally unwell to pick this up. Especially if you're from America, you have to be a little bit mentally unwell, or at least up for a challenge.
it was so surprising to me. But of course, I mean, what do you expect from a rag like the Wall Street Journal anyway? But there you have it.
Right now. No, I'm just kidding. well, anyway, speaking of rags and controversy, the Miami meeting happened today. What other place? I mean, really, should we really take the group of Ukrainians to Miami? But I digress. Let's take a look.
There, but the progress throughout the week, as we've been communicating, the end goal is obviously not just the end of the war. Obviously, that's central and fundamental. We want to see the end of the killing and the death and the suffering. And I'm sure the Ukrainian side, I know they do as well. They want peace. But it's also about securing an end to the war that leaves Ukraine sovereign and independent and with an opportunity at real prosperity. So this is not just about ending a war. This is about ending a war in a way that creates a mechanism and a way forward that will allow them to be independent and sovereign, never have another war again, and create tremendous prosperity for its people. Not just rebuild the country, but to enter an era of extraordinary economic progress. It's a country, Ukraine has tremendous economic potential. Ukraine has tremendous opportunity for true prosperity. Obviously, you can't do that in the middle of a war like this, but ending the war alone won't achieve that. So this is not just about peace deals. It's about creating a pathway forward that leaves Ukraine sovereign, independent, and prosperous. And so we expect to make even more progress today. And we're grateful that you would travel all the way here to Florida. We apologize for the rain. It's not supposed to be raining, but there's only certain things we can control. So thank you.
I really hate the idea, and I even feel sorry for the Ukrainians. I hate the idea of Witkoff, Kushner, and Rubio. And they all look so, like, bored. Like, is this...
they are bored.
Yeah. I mean, look at... This is Rubio after the meeting. He looks like, just like, why are we here?
Are we gonna... Yeah. All right. And I apologize because I'm pressed for time. I think we both are. But I just wanted to update you. We had another very productive session building off Geneva, building off the events of this week. As I told you earlier this morning, our goal here is to end the war. But it's more than just to end the war. We don't just want to end the war. We also want to help Ukraine be safe forever. So never again will they face another invasion. And equally importantly, we want them to enter an age of true prosperity. We want the Ukrainian people to emerge from this war, not just to rebuild their country, but to build it back in a way that'll be stronger and more prosperous than it's ever been. And so this is comprehensive, what we're working on here today. It's not just about the terms that ends.
I can't even play the whole thing. It's just...
No, it's so bad.
He really said the same thing that he said when they were in the meeting. Same exact thing. It's like, I have my paragraph. This is what I read. I got to go. We're in Miami. I got a war to start in Venezuela, which is what we're going to get to next. But before we get to that, I just want to do my propaganda part. This is for you, Mother Russia. Let's take a look. That's a Ukrainian cargo plane.
In
Tel Aviv.
Yep.
Only caught by eyewitness footage. No reason that we would have never known otherwise if somebody didn't post that footage, because there's been no announcement.
Yep.
There's been no nothing. Okay. Yep. So the speculation is that it's more Patriot system components or Rafael Spider air defense systems, which is another system that Ukraine is supposed to be getting. Guys, remember, this is not the first time. So with the Russia and Israel stuff, please. And I'm once again going to use this opportunity to plug myself. Go read the article, Gaza to Donbass, How Israel and Ukraine Built a Transnational War Machine, because it's going to get even more real. And you'll see as we continue to go on through this episode, but beyond the war, beyond the flights and all of the supplies, Israel has supplied tech valued over $100 million for free to Ukraine, thousands of tons of gear, plus satellite. They share satellite intelligence, and Ukrainian troops are trained on Israeli systems while they're in Europe. So, guys, the jig is up. I'm tired. Anyway, I have to do that all the time. Also, it looks like the conspiracy theorists are actually catching up with this finally. Before it was, you know, the Bolsheviks are all Jews. I don't know. They killed Ukrainian Christians. I don't even know what it was before. But anyway, it looks like we're making some progress. So check out this weird video I found. It's kind of interesting.
Slava Ukraina!
A Jewish state will be built in the south of Ukraine.
God bless America, God bless Israel, God bless Ukraine.
In Ukraine, everyone is Jewish, but not everyone knows it. A Jewish state will be built in the south of Ukraine. There is such a project. That's why we are all here for a reason. There will be immigration to Ukraine. There will be 70 million people here. Did you know? I was given a fir tree for my inauguration. Ukraine is impossible without Jews. Everything in Ukraine is Jewish culture. Look around, Petya. Remember, there was nothing here that was, is not, and never will be yours.
I like when the conspiracy theorists that have all the engagement kind of share my opinions. It's very helpful. I just came across that guy. And while I might not always agree with the conspiracy theorists, I like his videos. I think they're kind of hokey and sort of creative. So I thought that was a little bit fun to share. No idea who he is, but whoever you are, that was an awesome video. And I'm glad that you're catching up.
Didn't Zelensky say he wanted it to be a new Israel?
Yeah, but they don't listen. People don't care. You know,
I'm just saying. And do you remember that Israeli member of the Knesset who went on RT and was like, we're going to come for Russia. We're going to destroy you, this and that. And he went like psycho on them. He's from the far right. Mm-hmm. I'm just saying. Very interesting.
Very interesting. Okay. Now we'll move to our backyard, our Monroe Doctrine, which may not be our backyard for much longer. We'll see. But anyway, so Trump commits an illegal act I don't know if it's illegal, just he can't do this. You can't close another sovereign state's airspace, especially via social media. But that's where we are, I guess. On Truth Social, Trump says all airlines, pilots, drug dealers, and human traffickers, I guess he means his friends, please consider the airspace above and surrounding Venezuela to be closed in its entirety. But of course, this does result in the airlines listening, because who knows? He might just start shooting airplanes out of the sky, shoots boats out of the water. Who the hell knows what's going to happen?
Nobody knows.
Right. Obviously, Venezuela called it a colonialist threat and declared it illegal, unjustified, and a violation. Maduro's holding strong to his peace, not war, but we will hold a sword to defend our land. Trump cannot legally close the airspace, according to the 1944 Chicago Convention, which states that only sovereign states control their own airspace. They can issue FAA advisories, which airlines obey, which is why you guys saw the airspace clear out, but they cannot declare the foreign airspace closed. So it's kind of like, I can't do this officially, but just my words alone are going to close the airspace. And it's another way to economically strangle Venezuela. And it is.
Yep.
It is economically affecting Venezuela. So we're on about a 3-week escalation timeline leading up to this moment, with November 6th, U.S. labels Maduro and his 25 officials members of a federal foreign terrorist organization. On the 13th, the Gerald R. Ford deploys. The 17th, the U.S. Navy sunk those narco subs. Then the 21st, FAA warning. That was the NOTAM for potential hazardous situation over Venezuela. On Thanksgiving, Trump tells the troops that 85% have been stopped by sea, and very soon we will expand inland, and hinted of airstrikes on the interior. And then on the 29th, he declared the airspace closed. Immediately, all 100% of all commercial carriers rerouted. Venezuelan exports dropped. 800,000 barrels per day of oil via Caribbean lanes because the tankers are rerouting as well. So we're trying to economically strangle Venezuela right now, just kind of doing sort of political maneuvering, I guess, in a way. But more interestingly, what came out this week as well is this article on Pete Hegseth ordering them to kill them all. It's very reminiscent of Vietnam.
Oh,
it's very interesting because we've been saying that Venezuela would be just like another Vietnam.
Well, I posted that yesterday, went viral, has a million views. Yeah, I said, with Maduro, I said, Venezuela will give America its second Vietnam, and everybody went.
You need to start boosting us. Stop sending me your stuff to boost.
You know, it's wild. But you know, when I was in Venezuela, Maduro said as much. He said, "Look, it's a jungle environment. Venezuela is bigger than the state of California. Good luck." Good luck to American servicemen going. And I just want to throw this out there because some people don't have a good sense of history. You remember FARC?
Yeah, we were talking about it in the space yesterday.
You remember where all those FARC fighters went after the peace agreement?
Yep.
Most of them are living in Venezuela. Mm-hmm. To the tune of thousands of FARC fighters. So I'm just saying, combine that with National Bolivarian Militia, peasant rebellion, indigenous people resistance, who knows? Afro-descendant, people in the Caribbean area. I'm just saying, you are in for a wild time if Americans put boot on the ground.
And this is going to be like Deer Hunter on meth.
Oh, and listen, oh, it's going to be brutal. And if they think that they're going to get past, don't forget, Venezuela has S-300s, book systems, and thousands of shoulder-fired surface-to-air missiles from Russia. So I'm just saying, if they're ready for that, game on. Game on, baby. They're going to make the Taliban look like, child's play. Because you're in it. You're in it at that point.
Agreed. So according to the Washington Post, during the September 2nd operation, intel analysts tracked a boat they believed was smuggling drugs enough to kill, what Trump says, 25 to 50,000 people. After the first strike, the drone footage showed that two men were still alive, to which Pete Hegseth then ordered them to kill them. Finish them, he said. That's a quote. And kill them all. But that is very illegal. Incredibly illegal. Hegseth has tried to issue a defense. I don't really care what he says. He calls it fake news. He tries to make this into a, they're going after the warriors. No, dude, they're coming after you. You issued the order. Why are you passing the buck? If you've ever served in the military, Chris was an officer. I was a Navy chief. You never, ever put your subordinates out in front of you when you're receiving criticism.
Never.
Ever, because the choice rests with you. There's also the saying, never be the senior person with the secret. Never, if you don't want to hold responsibility for the order, don't make it.
Exactly.
Don't pass the buck to the people who carried it out, ever.
Exactly. Right.
So on October 16th, Admiral Alvin Halsey of Southcom, overseeing all of this, quit. This is in the middle of his term. He has resigned. The New York Times flagged that he raised concerns about the strikes. Now, I started doing a little bit of digging, found a couple posts. Here is John McCormack, and he says, what a coincidence that the admiral in charge of the campaign against alleged drug boats announced his resignation on the same day the U.S. Navy had, for the first time, rescued survivors from one of the strikes.
Yep.
Okay. He's, of course, plugging his article in the Dispatch, which I do suggest it's a little older from the beginning of the month, but there's something very weird going on with these Venezuelan strikes, more than meets the eye. Max Blumenthal also picked up our post. Thanks, Max, for that retweet and ratioing. I know I'm just kidding. Ratio us. Blumenthal, look, it's now clear why the top JAG officer in U.S. Southcom leaked his opposition to Trump extrajudicial murder campaign in the Caribbean. The Southcom commander announced his early retirement, and Hegseth booted the press from the Pentagon days after ordering this war crime. You guys remember that media has been booted out of the Pentagon, has been replaced with Laura Loomer, and has not come back.
Correct.
So that's kind of where we are. We're in a very strong media black hole. Go ahead.
I would say we are in the same spot. If you remember, I remember it vividly, before the buildup to the Iraq, or during the buildup to the Iraq war in 2003. In 2002, a lot of very high prominent generals and senior NCOs resigned from the military when they realized what was going on, when the drumbeats started to go towards war, when Dick Cheney and everybody started to push for an invasion of Iraq. They said, whoa, 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 whoa. According to the intelligence that we know, and according to our estimates from you know, sort of strategic intelligence that we have at the Pentagon, there's no link between Saddam Hussein and Osama bin Laden. That link was being forged, you know, illegally, dossiers being created, everything, you know it. We have Colin Powell going with the little vial, right? But there were a lot of very high profile defections. This Southcom resignation smells very much like that moment back then. And that's why I want people to understand a lot of people are resigning. A lot of people are very concerned because they know they're going to be on the docket if this thing goes sideways. And it looks like it's about to go sideways.
Yeah. And speaking of former JAGs, when I was in the military, the JAG Corps was like the boys, like the JAG Corps was like the, like, I think it was the movie that really, what was it, 12 Angry Men, the JAG Corps?
The one, are you talking about the one with Tom Cruise?
Yeah. What was that movie called?
A Few Good Men.
Few Good Men. That's it.
Oh,
yeah.
It was the best. That movie. Really?
Yeah. Everybody wanted to be a JAG because of that. Well, so here's former JAGs. They come out and with a letter in protest. They say they unanimously consider both the giving and the execution of the orders a war crime, murder, or both. If the U.S. military operation to interdict and destroy suspected narco trafficking vessels is a non-international armed conflict, as the Trump administration suggests, orders to kill everybody are war crimes.
They are.
Period. And they go on and on and on. You guys can read this. It's widely available, publicly available. And they end it with, the bottom line is that since the orders to kill survivors of an attack at sea are patently illegal, anyone who issues or follows such orders can and should be prosecuted for war crimes, murder, or both. That's why they're quitting. That's why the Democrats came out with that video. While it was cringe and gay, we didn't play it on the show, but they did say, you guys are being asked to commit war crimes. You need to let somebody know. If you're being asked to do unlawful orders, you need to let somebody know. And that's 100% true and responsible. That's what you're supposed to do.
As a former military officer, I can tell you, according to the laws of armed conflict and according to the UCMJ, you have no obligation to carry out illegal orders. You have an ethical obligation to not carry them out. Remember, the Nuremberg defense, I was just following orders, is not a defense.
It doesn't work.
It is not a defense. Your defense is your moral compass and your ethical duty. And your ethical duty are to follow clearly the laws of armed conflict and all of the laws in the Hague Conventions, the Geneva Conventions, and everything that's been agreed upon internationally for the rules of armed conflict. If you violate those, you open yourself up to prosecution for that. So I just want people to know that if you're a member of the military, you're watching this stream, for people like myself who were in the military, we know very well what those rules are and what the rules of engagement are and what's necessary for the use of force. So I hope that everybody out there will use their moral and ethical compass and not follow orders that are illegal, because if they are illegal, you will be held accountable for those.
Well, let's really get into who they're serving if they do actually carry out those orders. So yesterday, Trump announced that he will be pardoning prior Honduran President Juan Orlando Hernandez, who was convicted in 2024 for trafficking over 400 tons of cocaine into the United States and running Honduras as a narco state. He was sentenced to 45 years, and Trump is set to pardon him. Okay. He ran a drug trafficking ring that ran from Colombia into Venezuela, into Honduras, and into the United States. Obviously, without the knowledge of Maduro.
Mm-hmm.
Ding, ding, ding. So he pardons this guy. Well, didn't Donald Trump just say that blowing up these boats was saving 25,000 to 50,000 people, whatever? So by his math, he just pardoned the guy that killed 5 million Americans. So that's Trump math. Trump also went, I think we touched on it. I don't know if I touched on a stream or it was in a space. Trump is also actively interfering with the Honduran election, which happens today or today, actually.
Yep.
And you guys can read it. I am reading all that. I'm happy for you or whatever. But yeah, here he posts the same thing 2 days in a row or three, like twice. It's just crashing out completely. I ain't reading all that, but you guys can go. And he says that he's backing up the candidate that would be in the line with the guy he just pardoned. The guy he just pardoned had ties to El Chapo. He had $1 million he received from El Chapo because he was taking bribes from the cartels and drug lords to obviously not prosecute them. $1 million from El Chapo. That is documented, and Trump is pardoning him.
I want to go on two levels. This is something that's been commonly spoken about, especially in the activist, more like, you know, I would say deep politics kind of community in the U.S. Let's look at it this way. Trump now has accused Venezuela of supplying which drug in particular to the United States?
Fentanyl.
Okay, let's look at the fentanyl level. Fentanyl level, originally years ago, for the past few years, where have they said that fentanyl came from?
China or Mexico.
Yeah, China via Mexico, right? Mm-hmm. So that has been, that's a lower level drug, mostly affecting a lot of the middle class, lower middle class, poor population in the U.S. Right. Uses an opioid substitute, right?
Right.
And so China was the target for that. Now this guy, right, Juan Orlando Hernandez, was convicted of trafficking what drug?
Cocaine. Cocaina.
Cocaine. Cocaine is considered to be what kind of drug? Do you think?
Who uses it? Oh, it's a high, upper class, elitist, rich people drug.
There we go. Now we put on our
lower addiction rate to that opioid.
Exactly. But now we put on our class analysis hat, because the different levels of drugs signify not only a class difference in relationship with those drugs, but also the strategic importance of each drug. Cocaine being heavily utilized by the upper middle class, upper classes, the elite, definitely used by the Wall Street bros, everything. I know this finance world. I graduated Ivy League schools. I know what it's like, right? Everybody's out there snorting, having a good time. But when crack cocaine went into which areas of the country? What did they target with the crack epidemic?
Black and poor.
Mashallah. They targeted black specifically areas. Why? Because they wanted to destroy black radicalism, especially right. In the Vietnam, post-Vietnam era. They wanted to really start to chip away Black Panther Party, Black Liberation Army, etc. So drugs have been both a source of power as well, and economic power and political power, but also a weapon and a tool to be used to control populations, to pin classes against one another, and ultimately to sort of create an elite drug versus a non-elite drug. And we remember the 90s, we remember the drug wars, the 80s. People who were cocaine convictions were much different than crack convictions. And I just want to say that we have to understand this. Trump is also playing this game because Trump is a byproduct of that whole era, right?
Oh, yeah.
You know what's going on. And I would not be surprised if people around Trump, I mean, we see it all the time with some of the influencers on the right and things like that. They're also doing coke. They're having a good time.
They're having great Gatsby parties. You can't have a great Gatsby party without cocaine and champagne.
Give me a break. So what I want to say is the following. This is very much connected to the deeper political ramifications for all of these different drugs and for what they mean for America's ruling class. Just keep that in mind, people, when you're thinking about these drugs and what they mean.
That makes sense. Plus, fentanyl cuts into the bottom line of big pharma.
You know.
I've gone over that enough in spaces. Really quick, we have some breaking news on Venezuela, so I'll play before we move into our next section. Thank you, sir. Trump on Maduro. Trump had a phone call with Maduro, apparently.
What? New York Times reported that you had a phone call with Maduro. Did you?
I don't want to comment on it. The answer is yes.
And can you tell us a little bit?
No,
about
I can't
it?
Do that.
Mr. President.
And another?
your warning mean that an airstrike is imminent, or should we not read it that way?
Don't read anything into it.
I don't know. Don't read anything into it. Our producer's like eating chicken wings and I'm starving. Great. Thank you. Thank you for showing us. I should put you on stage for that, honestly, while you stuff your face with chicken wings. I won't, but I should. I won't because I'm feeling very kind today. I crashed out enough yesterday. Anyway, this is where I really want to take us today. This is the crux of the matter. The Isaac Accords. They are laughing at us, you guys. First, we've got the Abraham Accords. Now we've got the Isaac Accords. Chris,
we have the sun, right?
Before we dive into the geopolitics, can you give them our biblical sort of a little bit of biblical context? We did it in the space yesterday, but I'd love to hear it from you because of your background.
All right. So we have Abraham, considered to be the father of the monotheistic tradition, specifically the Abrahamic faith, Christianity, Islam, Judaism. And he has this famous sequence where he's going up and, you know, God has sort of tested him, said, you know, will you sacrifice your son? He said, I'm ready to sacrifice, right? And so we have this whole scene and we have also the sacrifice and then we have the salvation that comes from that, right? Where instead God says, okay, you love me enough. I know you're gonna put the dagger in and burn him or whatever. Please don't stop. Time out. You're one of mine, right? But the deeper thing is the line of descendants and how people claim lineage to Abraham, right? So we have on one side, we have Islam who claims lineage to Abraham through who? Do you remember?
Ismail?
Yes, Ishmael. Okay, good. Oh my God. Sarah. So you're getting an A in biblical studies class. So we have Ishmael, and then we have the Jews who descend from which other son?
Isaac.
Aha, there we go. So it's a very interesting, see, the Abraham Accords, I like the name because it also includes Muslims in that. Isaac Accords cuts the other way and actually doesn't include Islam as a branch necessarily. Because if you read it that way, like when I hear Isaac Accords, I'm like, oh, that's done strategically. Because now they're trying to bifurcate the whole thing and trying to say, actually, we're also in a different direction here. So I think that the name is very interesting to pick. And
there's the story. Doesn't Isaac sell his birthright? Does it somebody sell their birthright? Or I don't know.
The stories about Isaac's life also are quite interesting. I think the more interesting part, because this is related specifically with peace and with the broader context of what happened in Gaza, right? The genocide, ecocide, everything that happened in Gaza, is that this is much more, I would say, antagonistic towards the other branch, you know, towards Islam, but towards the other branch of Abraham. And it's kind of playing on that. If you read it that way, it can play on it very much. And that's why when I first heard it, I was like, oh, that was a strategic move. Somebody really thought about that one.
So let's get into it a little bit. So we have this Isaac Accords. It's a new initiative quietly launched this year. It's getting like zero attention. I think we've covered it, The Cradle, and then maybe Jerusalem Post. It's the Isaac Accords, a project designed to formalize a political, economic, and security bloc between Israel and Latin America. It was created through a new U.S.-based nonprofit called the American Friends of Isaac Accords, which I thought was interesting that its acronym is AFOIA. FOIA. Very interesting. They're always doing stuff like that. And it's seeded with funds from the Genesis Prize Foundation. And the initiative is directly tied to this year's Genesis Prize laureate. Now, what you guys are like, what the hell is the Genesis Prize? Well, the Genesis Prize is, quote, the most prestigious prize, the most prestigious award in the Jewish world. See, if you guys remember, the Nobel Prizes were all won by Jews because they used to have a special voting system. And when the Nobel Committee changed that voting system, they created the Genesis Awards because I really hate that where the world is like this. So the Genesis Awards are really only given to Jews or people that are helping Jews and making a difference in sort of Jewish. Time magazine calls it the Jewish Nobel Prize. These are their words. I'm not coming. This is not me. Okay. So who won this year's Genesis Prize? Oh, they're an interesting name, right? The Genesis Prize?
The Genesis Prize. That's well, it.
Who won it this year? There he is. There's Millet, just an absolute psychopath, right? So he wins it this year.
He's a great economist, didn't you know?
Yeah, fantastic. So, brilliant. So the Isaac Accords are described by the Israel's UN ambassador, Danny Danon, as a way to counter regional hostility toward the Jewish state and pull undecided Latin American countries into Israel's orbit. Keep that in the back of your mind. Who is the most hostile to the Jewish state in South America? Keep that in the back of your mind as we continue to talk about this. The AFOIA itself was also founded with the Genesis Prize Foundation. And we'll go into a little bit of that. That was founded by a group of Russian-Israeli, I hate them, they say Russian-Israeli, Soviet-Israeli, Russian-speaking Israeli, billionaires. Mm-hmm. Friedman, Avin, Khan, Polovets, and Nasser, and historically tied to both the Israeli government and diaspora political networks. Now, this year, the Isaac Accords is a new thing, and so they're making it, so the Genesis Prize awardee will then give their prize, which is $1 million, to the Isaac Accords. So it's a nice little money laundering scheme.
Oh, yeah.
So Millet gets his prize money and then turns it around and says, I am going to reinvest this back into the cause. Here's a clip of his acceptance speech.
Israel es un ejemplo radical de todos estos valores que hicieron a Occidente grande. Porque es una porque en su fundación era poco más que un desierto y en tan solo casi 80 años fue convertido gracias al trabajo incansable de sus ciudadanos en un oasis de prosperidad y crecimiento. Por eso apoyar a Israel es necesario para nuestro país, porque significa apoyar los valores que hace 100 años nos hicieron grandes, pero que abandonamos y por abandonarlos nos hundimos en la miseria. Es así que hoy más que nunca tenemos que redoblar nuestro compromiso con el bien y la verdad, tanto dentro como fuera del país. Hoy más que nunca es nuestro deber moral defender la verdad de estos valores judeocristianos. Porque sin lugar a dudas, en ese compromiso férreo con el bien, sin importar las críticas, el que le muestra al mundo que hoy somos un país mejor. Y esto es también algo necesario para hacer a la Argentina grande nuevamente. Muchas gracias a todos por su atención. Que Dios lo bendiga y que la fuerza del cielo nos acompañe. I'm Israel Hay.
I'm Israel Hay.
Hi.
Jesus. Like, seriously, it's everybody's making things great again. He is the new tropical Trump. If you guys don't remember, Bolsonaro was our old tropical Trump, who, by the way, last week tried to cut his ankle bracelet off with a soldering iron and escaped to the United States. He's back in prison. Like, you really can't make it's a telenovela down there. It's not even, I mean, we're laughing, but Jesus, it's not even funny. So anyway, back to this Genesis Prize thing. It was launched. Here we go. Here's the homepage. There she is. There she is. Miss
Wonder Woman.
Miss Israeli actress. Wonder Woman. Anyway, it was. We told you guys it was founded by five Jewish philanthropists back in 2013. The idea itself was created in 2012 with the help of none other than Eli Wiesel, who we all know now is a complete fabricationist and fantasist. Anyway, every year they give $1 million to their prize money. It is a distinguished committee of Jewish leaders, philanthropists, and figures, evaluates nominees based on professional excellence, Jewish engagement, and societal impact. Ceremony is held in Jerusalem as of November 2025. Every laureate has donated the full prize money to charitable causes. And like I said, from now on, will most likely be donated to the Isaac Accords or something similar. Some noted laureates include Natalie Portman, of course, because where would we be without Natalie Portman?
Oh, yeah.
Robert Kraft, Millay. Oh, look at this. Israeli organizations and activists. And look at this one. Jewish activists and NGOs supporting Ukraine. But I digress.
About
the prize.
Interesting.
Little bit. Yep. A little blurb here. The mission of the Genesis Prize is to foster Jewish identity, inspire Jewish pride, and strengthen the bond between Israel and the diaspora. Keep all these things in the back of your mind as we continue to talk about this. Under Impact is the other place I wanted to take you guys really quickly. Under the Israel Latin American one is where you'll find more information about what's going on with the Isaac Accords right over here, down here. And then they have tons of links to what's going on. Yalla Israel, you can't make it up. Oh, Stand With Us is down there too. Some of you guys might be familiar with that. Here's the other one, Supporting Ukraine. There she is. There she is. Look at all the stuff they do in Ukraine. Access Israel. Blue check Ukraine. Here's the one where they propagandize children through trauma therapy. They're all over the place. Hillel International, Israel Aid. I guess that's like USAID. I don't know. Like, it's just on and on and on. And there's Barbara Streisand. Papa, can you hear me? What is that song? From Yenta? Yeah, it's insane. So please, guys, please help me push back against the conspiracy theories. I just wanted to show you that as well while we continue to go through this Genesis Prize. Core pillars of the Isaac Accords. This is what countries will have to do in order to get into them. Move all their embassies to Jerusalem. Argentina will move theirs in the spring. It's the eighth nation to do so. They will have to label Hamas and Hezbollah as terrorist organizations. They will have to promise to flip in the UN and the OAS votes and start to vote with Israel. Latin America has historically voted 70% against Israel on Palestinian resolutions. They will be required to invest in agrotech, water tech, and innovation trade. If you guys know anything, Israel is very big on buying agricultural and water rights in countries around the world. They own part of the water rights in countries like El Salvador and other places. They will have to promote student youth exchanges and anti-Semitism education programs. Joint anti-terrorism pacts. They will have to agree to intelligence sharing against China and Iran influence in Venezuela, Cuba, and Bolivia. They will be required to build a pro-U.S. regional bloc to counter BRICS and strengthen U.S. allies in the global south as traditional Western support for Israel has been eroding, right? They're giving up on Europe. They are pivoting. You guys have to pay attention to this stuff. This rollout this year, obviously, Argentina is the first member. He is the rollout pioneer. The target countries for this year are Uruguay, Panama, which the United States has already taken care of, but trying to kick China out, and Costa Rica, where projects are already underway. Next year, this is also ties right back into a bow. We have Brazil, Chile, hopefully Colombia, because they're interfering with the election there, and El Salvador, right? Of course.
Oh, yeah. Of course.
Then they have on their official watch list Paraguay, Guatemala, and Honduras. What the play is here? You guys see what's going on? You guys see why there's a carrier strike group off the coast of Venezuela? And it ain't for fentanyl.
Mm-mm. No, it's definitely not for fentanyl. If it was for fentanyl, they had to just go to Langley, go down the street.
Right. So the Isaac Accords was officially launched in Buenos Aires. And there's Millay with Gideon Saar. And so that's where we're at. We have the Isaac Accords. Running the American Friends of the Isaac Accords is Ambassador Fitz Haney. He's the former U.S. ambassador to Costa Rica. He's worked for Citibank, Procter & Gamble, Pepsi, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. They are officially tracking three indicators of success: public opinion shifts. They will be measuring pro-Israel attitudes via polling and social analytics, cultural and economic exchange by flights, student programs, and economic deals, and political realignment by voting in the UN and OAS, new embassies, and terrorism designation. And they have said, with Europe turning hostile to Israel post-Gaza, we are now shifting towards the global south.
Oh my God.
I want to stress to our viewers, we approach the Venezuelan war. I approach it from a non-Zionist motivation angle. And I was really just focused on Trump and America and the oil and the BRICS and China. And now it's this. And I'm like, I hate it. I hate this so much.
I did a video.
This is written by Jared Kushner, because it's a carbon copy of the Abraham Accords adapted for Latin America. So this is not being done without Trump's knowledge.
I did a video in Venezuela this summer when I was there, and I went to the fortress, the citadel at the top of the hill where Hugo Chavez is buried. And you know what is prominently behind his coffin next to the Venezuelan flag? The Palestinian flag. The flags at Hugo Chavez's coffin, at his mausoleum, are the Venezuelan flag and the Palestinian flag. I want you to know that and remember that. Venezuela is supporting Palestine. Venezuela supported Syria under Assad, supported Hezbollah, supported Iran, supported the resistance, and supports Palestine from day one till now. Just remember that when you see potentially jets flying over Caracas and bombing presidential palace at Miraflores and things like that, just remember that Maduro never once waved the Israeli flag,
never,
but every time waved the Palestinian flag and had the keffiyeh around his neck. Just remember that, because that is part of the equation here, no doubt about it.
What did Machado say? One of her first things would be to open it up to privatization and move the embassy. And they're all saying the same thing. You come to us, Habibi. You won't need Saudi Arabia anymore. Come to us, Habibi. It's very, very scary. This needs to be taken seriously. So I guess it's time for our once in a while tinfoil hat segment.
Oh, I'm ready.
I was in a space yesterday. A very kind woman named Donna came to me and started saying, "Have you heard of this organization called Kulanu?" And I was like, "Oh, what? I don't know. You know, these little organizations, I don't really pay them a whole lot of mind." But I did. I looked into this one and I said, "Oh, wow, this is interesting." So here is Kulanu. They are a organization that goes and finds hidden Jewish communities inside of South America. Really, really wild stuff. It's the word Kulanu means he is Hebrew for all of us. It was founded in 1994 after the Ethiopian airlifts. Its mission is to identify, support, and sometimes convert emerging, isolated, and returning Jewish communities around the world, mostly deep inside of South America. Their focus in the region is, quote, this is them saying it, crypto Jews, descendants of Sephardic Jews who fled the Inquisition in 1492 and kept Jewish traditions in secret for centuries, from remote Peruvian tribes to underground Brazilian shoals. Kulanu is now handing out grants. They obviously are a legal nonprofit. They're ran by Jack and Diane Zeller. And I went through and I obviously looked into their operations. They have things in Brazil, Suriname, Peru, Colombia, Puerto Rico, where they are finding. So for instance, in Brazil, they gave $80,000 to some weird Orthodox group to facilitate conversions. In Peru, they created an Incan Sephardic crypto-Jewish community.
Yes, yes, yes. I know about this because there's a Peruvian family that went over that indigenous.
Correct. So I was like, okay, this is very small. So I was like, this can't be that really that major. Are there other organizations like this? There are. There are hundreds that are working inside of South America to convince tribal people that they're Jewish, to teach people about the Jewish ancestry. There's one called Jutina, which is a new nonprofit focused on cultivating and celebrating Latin Jewish identity. There's a Society for Crypto-Judaic Studies. There's a group called Shave Israel, which calls itself an organization to locate individuals and groups who are the lost Jews. It's crazy. It's so nuts. I don't want to get too deep into it, but this is wild. Yeah, it is called Jutina Chai, I swear. Jutina E Company. It's wild. Guys, go through this stuff and see what's really going on. See what's really going on.
I don't even know what to think anymore about, like, this stuff is definitely, without a doubt, on one side, soft power of the Zionist project. On the other side, totally and without question, part of Mossad intelligence, networking, gathering, and operations. No doubt in my mind that they are extending their networks into all of these areas.
The cherry on, or the, I guess the icing on this horrible cake is that every single one said, we don't operate in Venezuela because it's too hostile.
Maybe that's why Daddy Trump has to go in with B2.
Mazzotto holding it down. Can he let the NGOs in?
You have to think about it this way. The Zionists, forget about Judaism as a religion, because they're great. I don't have a problem with them, you know, whatever. I'm not, you know, anti-Semitic in any sense of the term. But I want to say that the Zionist project has always been at the forefront about ensuring their power and survival. And by doing that, they have, of course, infiltrated Jewish communities, and they have located semi-Jewish, kind of messianic, all this kind of, even like borderline, like evangelicals who like the Old Testament, they've identified these communities and they've tried to build and expand their influence within them. So much so that in my travels in Latin America, sometimes I'll see a random restaurant with an Israeli flag and I'm like, are they Jewish? And they're like, no, they're evangelical Christian.
Yes. See, that's another thing we talked about in the space yesterday. Brazil is being completely subverted by evangelicals that are staunch Zionists. So that's another method that they're using.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. So Protestantism, a lot of these, like, you know, much more extreme kind of evangelical or charismatic or Pentecostal kind of Christians, they are totally about Israel.
Yeah. That was an easy segue in Brazil. They converted those Catholics very easily over to Protestantism, more so than a lot of the other South American countries. But Brazil is very much not needing any of these sort of Zionist programs because they're just going to go after Lula next election. And all of these evangelicals are there.
Of course. And for Orthodox Christians, by far the most inoculated to this kind of garbage about Israel are the Orthodox Christians, because Orthodox Christianity has one of the, so if you have the Pentarchy, which are the five ancient seats of the bishoprics, the sort of ancestral sees of Christianity, Rome, Constantinople, Antioch, Jerusalem, Alexandria. Jerusalem, the Greek Orthodox Patriarch of Jerusalem, Theophilus, his official title says, of all Palestine.
Yeah.
Not Israel, Palestine. The church is the new Israel. Israel as a political entity for the Jewish people no longer exists, cannot exist, was part of the New Testament. I will destroy the temple and remake it. That was Christ himself. The church now is the broader. It went from a very particular religious, ethno-religious group to a universalizing group, to a universal church, to a universal community, salvation for all, and all of creation. So in this way, I think about, like, now that I'm here in Russia and speaking with a lot of Orthodox Christians, they don't, what Israel? Mm-hmm. What, please? Actually, the title of Moscow throughout history has been Third Rome, Second Jerusalem. And there's a church here that's built as an exact replica of the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem, here in Moscow, outside of Moscow. So I just want people to think about that, that the different Christianities have, the different branches have their own tendencies. And for sure, the Protestants are the weak link because they have the least amount of tradition historically to ancient Christianity. And they are more biblically based, which lends much more credence to the Old Testament as a separate entity and trying to even incorporate Old Testament laws and rules, which were totally abrogated by Jesus in the New Testament, right? So I just want people to recognize that when they're thinking about this. And that's the power that the Zionists have identified in trying to propel themselves into some of these branches of Christianity to strengthen their power and to garner more support. That's huge at this point.
Looks like breaking news again. The United States has issued NOTAMs, no-fly zone over sections of Venezuela's southern border to remain active until March 1st. That's breaking. I don't know much details. We'll look into it and we'll post about it, but we've got to bring this to an end. It's been over 90 minutes. Just want to leave you guys with one more rabbit hole that I happened to stumble upon yesterday. Chris, you might enjoy this. Somebody came to me in a space and said, Scott Bessent feels off to me. I said, let's explore this a little bit. So we did. We looked up Scott Bessent and we went to a section on his Wikipedia that says clubs. And there's this club that he belongs to called Dialogue. Very interesting. I'd never heard of it until yesterday. Peter Thiel founded it 19 years ago. Experts compared it to the Bilderberg and World Economic Forum. Mm. In 2025, the group purchased land in Washington, D.C. for a campus. If you guys recall, there's been many, many, many high cost per plate meals that Trump has been having around Washington, D.C. with the tech bros. This is probably that. But I want you guys to go look at the participants. Rima Al Saud. If you guys have noticed, even on our show, we played clips where Trump's saying, Rima, Princess Rima, she's got a lot of cash. What is she doing in a supper club with Peter Thiel, Scott Bessent, Cory Booker, Ted Cruz, Tulsi Gabbard, Reid Hoffman, Jared Kushner, Elon Musk, Larry Summers, Peter Thiel, and the one that stuck out to me, Kaya Kallas.
Interesting. Very interesting.
So maybe a rabbit hole we dive down at a further date, or maybe you guys do it for us, but very, very weird if they're comparing it to WEF and the Bilderberg, and we've got, this is a new world order, dude. This is new world order type stuff. Absolutely. 100%.
I'm on the cap.
Let's get to our super chats. Thanks always, Joseph. Hummus, I hope you took all your notes. Uncle Haas, you are crazy. Yeah, yesterday was a doozy. I crashed out a little bit. I don't really care though. No regrets. I'm sorry if it hurt anybody's feelings, but sometimes
we love you, Abu Jan. We love
it. To be said. Why do you keep blaming? We don't blame the public at all. We look through everything through a class lens. We're working class solidarists. I guess working class Islamophobes be like Ali Akbar and Shakira Law. Thank you. Happy 25th. Thanks for all of you guys, actually. Agreed on Russian U.S. Okay. And the childish unnecessary provisions and behavior overall. Russia hope. How is the mafia in Russia still holding on strong, Chris?
I mean, they're around everywhere in every country, in every location to a greater or lesser extent. But, you know, Russia cracks down on corruption. They cracked down the Azerbaijan mafia recently. Of course, that was part of the huge geopolitical, you know, shockwaves between Russia-Azeri relations. Now they've sort of, you know, settled down, but they knocked down the whole Azerbaijan mafia network pretty harshly here.
And Will, thank you for always joining and supporting. I'm not reading your name. Bold prediction. Russia reaches the port of Odessa. Putin calls Trump and tells him Mother Russia agrees to a ceasefire along the current battle lines. I mean, in an ideal world, I guess.
I'm hoping for that. I mean, that's my dream. We'll see if we get there, but that would be the best.
Kudos to the producer, as always. Yes, we know they ain't happy with Mexico. We've talked about that a lot. Thank you from Germany. And yes, I will leave you with rabbit holes, black pills, and nightmares. That's my literal job. I'm scared. I want you all to be scared with me. This is really serious really grave stuff. But thank you for being a mod and working for mere pennies for your time, Haas. It's very, very kind of you. But thanks, all of you. And I want you guys to look into the stuff we talked about today. We will try to get into the El Salvador space tomorrow. I have no idea the currency here, but this looks... Argentina. Administration is based on deep recession and unlimited debt. Debt already saved twice by Trump. That's funny. That's what our economy is based on in the United States. First through FMI and then through U.S. Treasury. It's destroying industry, liquidating strategic assets, and surrendering sovereignty. There are seven former J.P. Morgan men leading economy. It's like the Chicago boys in Chile all over again, just hopefully less violent. That you're hearing it directly from the people that are living there. It's horrible. And then the Venezuelans will come tell you, we're fine. And all the Americans say, we know better than both of you. It's just...
I want to institute something for our program at the end. I want to do a prediction to the next show because I really enjoy every show coming on and seeing if we were right.
We've been pretty good, dude. We've been like 85-90%.
We are spot on. And I think that's due to a lot of good historical context and understanding the trend lines in history. But I want to ask you, what are you thinking about these next few days? I'm traveling once again, so I'll be in another place and I'll be, you know, talking to you all there on Wednesday. But I want to ask, what are your thoughts for the few days to come?
I don't think anything will happen between now and our Wednesday show. Mondays, Tuesdays are usually very slow. This is a very long no-fly zone. I don't think this is designed for military strikes. I think this is designed for economic threat.
Okay.
What do you think?
No, I think you're right. I think there's a lot of saber rattling going on, but I think that they're slowly getting the pushback.
They are.
I would predict that Monday, Tuesday, we might see a resolution in the House or the Senate for no military action again. In Venezuela without a congressional authorization, without a congressional declaration of war, going through the congressional process. I think we're going to see a lot of pushback. We're going to see also the circuit of the media coming out Monday, Tuesday, and see what mainstream media is talking about. I'm going to be keen on that.
Yeah, they're engaging public opinion big time.
Of course. And I also think that Witkoff is coming. I think that we're going to see just baby steps. But like I said, two step forward, one step back. And I don't think we're going to see much in terms of a breakthrough just quite yet.
I agree. And keep an eye on Trump and Witkoff and Kushner in Russia. I can't wait to see how this goes, how this pans out. Midterm elections for us are in 2026, a year from about 3 weeks ago. So they're coming up quickly and they are pretty much in the bag for the Democrats, which I'm not even happy to even say. But we'll leave you on that very low note. I do have something very funny to take you guys out and we will see you guys on Wednesday. Keep reading. Find us tomorrow for El Salvador and jump down those rabbit holes so we don't have to. We'll see you guys on Wednesday.
Take care.
We're the Democrats.
We care about the issues of everyday people. Gas prices, paying your Jamaican nanny, trips to Israel.
Never forget, slavery lasted over 200 years. Because progress takes time.
You know how many strongly worded letters I could write with this bad boy?
We're the Democrats.
We know what our constituents want. Liz Cheney's endorsement.
Remember Obama, guys? I mean, remember 2008?
We're going to stand up for gay people. For black people, for Black Rock, Black Water Mercenaries, Blackstone, Black Sites, Black Ops.
We're the Democrats.
If Mamala had the nuclear codes, we'd be at brunch right now.
Believe woman. Like, believe billionaire woman, you know, at least.
We can't do anything except condemn socialism. We're the Democrats.
They're not war crimes when we're in power. They're... All right, you guys hate Donald Trump, right? Like, what are we doing here?
I mean, yeah. We take money from AIPAC. I mean, we take your money. We take anybody's money. I mean, your money, Epstein's money. I mean, we just really need that bag.
We protect trans people. We protect sports from trans people. What the f*** is going to make y'all for us? You're so needy!
We're the Democrats!
What do we stand for?
We're the Republicans.
We believe in traditional values. The man is the breadwinner, church on Sundays, segregation, teenage pregnancy.
I mean, how bad was slavery?
We can be bipartisan. For example, Israel.
We're the Republicans.
Immigrants are ruining this country. Except for my wife.
Wait, who is Bubba? This is just how we say hello.
We're the Republicans.
Abortion is murder. Unless it's for my wife.
These emails are communism.
If you're poor, we fucking hate you.
We're the Republicans.
Okay, look. We needed to touch Gen Z somehow.
Well, so technically that's an ephebophile. It's a different thing.
He's not a pedophile. He's a cinephile. He only has the movies.
Okay, like, what's wrong with islands? My wife is from an island.
We're the Republicans?
So we can be bipartisan.
bisexual.